This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and we start today in newsrooms. Not ours, but many others, because the media industry has seen another wave of layoffs. The country's largest publisher, Gannett, laid off about 200 people nationwide, including at regional papers like the Providence Journal and the Massachusetts-based publication South Coast Today. CNN recently cut hundreds. BuzzFeed, 12% of their staff. And on November 30th, NPR announced it would drastically reduce hiring. Now, in a time with rampant mis- and disinformation, national outlets are hurting and local news organizations are fighting for survival, even as local communities become the new front line in the struggle for democracy. So let's dive beneath the headlines on what's happening and how it affects the future of news here in the Commonwealth. To help us do that, Northeastern University School of Journalism professor and media commentator Dan Kennedy is here with us in Studio 2. Dan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
Great to have you here. And on the line, Jen Paluzzi. She's a Massachusetts news veteran and the editor-in-chief of the nonprofit weekly newspaper, The Concord Bridge, which launched in the fall of this year. Jen, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Jen, I'm going to start with you because you've been in the industry here in the Commonwealth for about two decades. And in that time, you've actually experienced multiple layoffs, haven't you?
I was laid off three times in a decade.
And what was, I don't mean to sort of be like, ooh, tell us how bad it was, but what was it like to be laid off three times in one decade?
Well, the first time it was from the Metro West Daily News, where I'd worked for over a decade at that point. And it was insulting because I was looking at other people left in the newsroom going, he's more useful to them than me. But I had a backup plan, which led to my second layoff, unfortunately. I had a blog. I started a company called Central Mass News. We made a dozen hyperlocal websites, hired a lot of reporters. Made the mistake, which Dan warned me against, of selling to another company, which then about a year later decided to shut down Massachusetts and lay me off again.
That was what, 2013?
That was 2013, yeah.
So fast forward, you go to the Lowell Sun, and then what
happened? I went to the Lowell Sun, where, you know, I joined my old mentor, Tom Zupa. And Zupa and I were a fantastic team for about, you know, 5 years. And then Zupa himself had to lay me off because the editor-in-chief, Jim Campanini, was in Italy. So that was a bit heartbreaking. Yeah, that was the worst one because it was like, come on.
Yeah, and now 4 years later, you've launched this nonprofit paper, The Concord Bridge.
Yes, well, I was chosen to launch it. There is a fabulous board of very concerned Concord citizens with very deep Concord connections. Three members were former select board members. One was a former museum director at the Concord Museum. We have another one who was a newspaper editor on Nantucket. So they know Concord. Everybody's been talking about the fact that the Gannett paper in town, the Concord Journal, has not really been covering Concord. And we were greeted with open arms, like, yes, I'm waiting for people to start saying, oh, no, you. But now everybody, every time I go into a store, it's like, oh, yes, we love you.
So let me bring Dan, let me bring Dan Kennedy into the conversation here. So Dan, two follow-up questions for you. I'll do them one at a time. First, Jen's story. Pretty familiar?
It's very familiar, although Jen may be an extreme version of that. Not only was she laid off by both of the two worst newspaper chain owners in the country, but she managed to get laid off by her hyperlocal startup, too. That's really quite a remarkable record, but it's also indicative, given where she finds herself now, it's really indicative of this renaissance of local news that we're seeing, mainly in the nonprofit sector, but not entirely.
So I want to pick up on that. One of the local nonprofit newspapers or news organizations, not papers, that we've been following is the emergence of the New Bedford Light over the last couple
yes.
of years. And they emerged after a paper they felt was greatly weakened and not following the local news. So in March, we spoke with their editor, Barbara Rossner, And she talked a little bit about the power of accountability that these local papers can provide. In this context, she's talking about the height of the Omicron surge. The state removed 4 vaccination clinics from New Bedford without giving an explanation.
We wrote a story about it. We couldn't get anybody to tell us why. They wouldn't answer us, but we wrote a story about it. And within 24 hours, those clinics were reinstated because of what we did, because we just got the information out there.
Jen, it sounded like you wanted to say something.
I didn't think I made a noise.
Okay. That might have been in the cut. Don't worry about it. That I'm going to turn back to Dan Kennedy here. So, Dan, the reason I wanted to play that cut is you just talked about these vibrant new small local news organizations. They're emerging. It's almost like watching a replacement process.
It is.
And what I want to get at for our listeners is, what is the process of replacement that's happening? At one point, we had vibrant for-profit local news journalism that made enough money, went every day in print and then both, and now all of a sudden it's like gut.
Well, first of all, very quickly, the New Bedford Light is kind of an outlier. It's wonderful. They do terrific work, but massively well-funded, very high profile. Very few communities can manage to do what they're doing in New Bedford. However, we're seeing lots of smaller projects in community after community. There is a real hunger for local news, and what Barbara Rosner was saying in that clip is indicative of why it's so important. We need to know what's going on at City Hall or Town Hall. We need to know what the City Council or the Select Board is doing. People want to know what's going on in the schools. And as Gannett, which is the major owner of local news outlets in eastern Massachusetts, continues to shrink to nothing, we're seeing entrepreneurial journalists and public-minded citizens band together to try to fill that gap.
So I want to get back to Jen. Jen, I'm going to come back to you in just a second, but there's one more follow-up question I want to ask Dan Kennedy from Northeastern University first, which is, why is this happening? Why is Gannett doing it? What's the business model that's falling apart that's leading to this sort of shrinkage and divestiture?
You know, I could have told you a couple of years ago what I thought Gannett's business model was. I don't know anymore. I think they're just trying to hang on. Now, I should point out that Gannett and its predecessor company, Gatehouse, have been going through round after round of cuts for, 15 years now. There's nothing new about this. It's getting particularly extreme now because they've cut all the low-lying branches, and now they're just cutting newspapers and coverage and everything else. Gannett took on a ton of debt when they merged with Gatehouse. And a lot of this is they're trying to pay down a massive amount of debt at a time when the revenues in this business are very challenging. Advertising's down, everything.
But a lot of it may not have anything to do with whether people want or need local news.
Absolutely not. People want this. They really do.
So Jen Paluzzi, editor-in-chief of the Concord Bridge, that launched recently. It is nonprofit, correct?
It is nonprofit.
How are you primarily making the money work?
Well, we had several things in our favor. One being that Concord is Concord, and people were not only passionate, but they had the money to donate to get us off the ground. We also received a substantial grant from the Knight Foundation in order to launch. And once we started asking for advertising, the advertisers were very, very eager to get on board with us. And, we've had to up our, we normally have 16 pages now, for December we have 20.
So that's fascinating, Jen, because it runs counter to the narrative that part of the reason that newspapers in print don't survive anymore is that, good old internet got rid of advertising and you have to be nonprofit because advertisers don't want to pay. That sounds like that's not your experience.
No. When the chains say that advertising doesn't pay, they're talking about national. They're not talking about going around down Main Street and, getting the Concord market to advertise your local realtor or local restaurant, they're, you know, they don't think that that's quite, you know, worth the time and effort to, that it takes to go in. But it also enhances the local feel of your paper. If you see that the people who are in your ads are also local and they're not, say, Coca-Cola.
So I'm going to play a little bit of sound here for you, Dan Kennedy. This is longtime local journalist Jason Premas of the Boston Institute for Nonprofit Journalism. He spoke with our producer, Andrea Perdomo Hernandez, and expressed some concern about the sustainability of this move to nonprofit model for local news.
Even if all the major foundations spent a lot of their budgets on nonprofit journalism in the U.S., they couldn't, and they will say this, they couldn't fund everybody that's trying to start up in every city and town and county, right? That's not possible.
And I do want to note, as I turn back to you, Dan, I'm sure there are listeners today saying, wait a minute, you guys at WBUR just finished a fundraiser earlier this week on Wednesday where you were biting your nails until the very end. We did meet our number, but we turn heavily to our listeners to fund us as part of our model because there isn't enough philanthropy out there without going to listeners to pay in.
Jason, who, by the way, does great work, makes a very good point. And something that I've been arguing as I've followed this sector for years is that the philanthropy ultimately is going to have to come from the local level. Because he's right, the national foundations can't possibly fund local news all across the country. So you need local philanthropy, you need member donations, you need some advertising. A lot of nonprofits and a lot of for-profits have built events businesses around what they're doing. You need a variety of different, and I do think that it's absolutely sustainable, but Jason's right in thinking that national foundations aren't going to be able to do this. Another point I wanted to make, Jen said, well, Concord is an ideal place to do this. Yes, indeed. That's good, and it's also worrying. I mean, you look around the Boston area, Concord, Marblehead, Lexington, they're doing very well with local news startups. But you get into more urban, diverse communities, it's much more difficult. We've got nothing where I live.
Although a witness, again, New Bedford, which is not the Concord profile.
New Bedford, yes. And that, as I said, that's this massive project that has gotten national attention. I would point to the New Haven Independent, which has been going strong for 17 years now, and which I wrote a book about. But they have buy-in from the local philanthropic community that's been able to keep them going for all this time.
So, Jen, in a couple of sentences, what are the stakes?
Democracy. I'll give you one word. And just, it's heartbreaking that you know more about celebrities. Like, I know more about Prince Harry and Meghan, you know, than I do about what happened in my own town's a select board meeting because I no longer cover it and I'm busy with other things. So we need an informed public and we need that more than ever. In our last Grafton race, we had some people who had nefarious intent when in running. They wanted to ban books. They wanted to not have masks in schools, the usual. So that's what, and sorry, that was more than two.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I do want to note from an editorial standpoint here at WBUR, I mean, those are policy positions. I'm not sure I would call them necessarily nefarious intent, but I understand what you're saying. So Dan, I'm going to turn back to you here, and I'm going to give you a little more sound now from Jason Premas of the Boston Institute for Nonprofit Journalism, talking about there's a solution maybe, but we don't quite have it coordinated yet.
The different foundations, the different rich people, the different institutions of various kinds that are sort of, you know, trying to do this and that to, like, quote unquote, save journalism. All of us on the ground doing it. There's not much coordination. There's a, you know, lot of cooks in the kitchen. Not you know, no one's come up with a good recipe yet.
Will we, Dan?
No, absolutely not. And I don't think we should.
Oh.
You know, my one thing that I have come to, I've concluded for years now is that the local news crisis will be solved one community at a time. And any effort to try to come up with any sort of systemic solution that provides quality news in every community in the country, I think is doomed to fail. You know, my research partner, Alan Clegg, and I have been studying local news startups around the country, and they're all different models, and they're all doing good work.
All right. That is Dan Kennedy, professor at Northeastern School of Journalism and a media commentator, and Jen Paluzzi, editor-in-chief of the Concord Bridge, longtime Massachusetts journalist. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now, the state of beer in our state.
When I started at this job 6 years ago, there were 120 breweries, and today there are 230 operational breweries, with 30 more in planning, slated to open at the close of this year or the beginning of next. So certainly no sign of slowing down at all.
That is Katie Stinchin, executive director of the Mass Brewers Guild, talking to us in our first edition of Brewed in Mass. Brewed in Mass is our series on the thriving and growing beer brewing industry in Massachusetts, which is ranked sixth in the nation, according to the beverage website VinePair. So it's December, and we thought for our second installment, how about shopping local? Here in Studio 2, Sarah Lee, Director of Business Operations at Medusa Brewing Company, which is located in Hudson, Massachusetts, and Kelsey Roth, who is a Cicerone, which we'll explain, and a board member for the Mass Brewers Guild, and is General Manager of Exhibit A Brewing in Framingham, Massachusetts. Sarah, Kelsey, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Great to have you. And since we are tasting, we invited one of our guests from the conversation we just finished on the state of local news, Northeastern Professor Dan Kennedy, to stick around and taste with us. Dan, thanks for sticking around.
Well, as you know, I actually just refused to leave, so here I am.
Got you. That's fantastic. Okay, so Kelsey, not everyone does know what a Cicerone is. I learned when we did the first segment of Brewed in Mass. So what is a Cicerone?
My brother keeps calling me a Cicerone, and I'm like, no, that's something completely different.
Yeah, I don't know what that is either.
So. It's a fried pork skin.
Fried pork skin. The easiest way to describe it is it's like a sommelier, but for beer.
Okay.
There's a training program and exams that you go through, and you cover beer, everything from how it's made to food and beer tasting and things like that.
So there are going to be two listeners in my head on that. One is going to say, right, I totally get that. And Sarah, the other one's going to say, how could there be enough beers that you would need to have a Cicerone?
You know, I think that's the common misconception when it comes to craft beer. People have a very narrow vision of what beer means to them, and they don't necessarily know that there's a whole world to explore out there. And a lot of the craft breweries in Massachusetts are doing some really fun, different styles and different techniques and coming out with all sorts of flavors. And I think you'll see that kind of reflected in some of the beers we brought today.
Yeah, so this is what we're going to do. We're going to taste and talk.
Awesome.
And the two of you brought two different things. Each of you brought one beer from your own collection, from Medusa and from Exhibit A. But you each actually, because we're talking a little bit about holiday shopping, you each actually brought a beer that you admire from someone else's business, correct?
Correct.
And that is part of what is striking about Brewed in Massachusetts, is that, I mean, you know, the free market works through competition. Anybody who's taken their macroeconomics knows that. And yet, somehow it seems like we've developed a fairly supportive ecosystem, Kelsey, here in the state.
Yeah, it's unique because I think we all kind of understand that, you know, the old phrase, a rising tide lifts all boats. And, you know, craft beer is still less than 30% of the overall beer market. And so we're kind of all in this together, and it's very collaborative. A lot of us are very small businesses, you know, with under 10 employees. So we need a lot of help, and so we lean on each other, and you know, we borrow CO2 from our friend's brewery or yeast, or you know, we run out of something, and you know, we need a sensor for our canning line, you know. So
yeah, and the CO2 thing is a big deal, right?
Yeah.
That's
a
key ingredient, right, Sarah? And there's been a shortage for more than a year now.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, a few of our brewing friends, you know, just within the state have had a lot of supply issues. Obviously, COVID caused a lot of those issues with just the supply chain being delayed or just non-existent. So unfortunately, a few of our friends have taken that hit. And, you know, hopefully we'll see some improvements here in the future. But I know, you know, within the Brewers Guild, even there's been a lot of conversations within our network saying, how can I help you? You know, do you need some CO2? I have an extra tank. Like,
so literally like borrowing a cup of sugar from you.
For sure. Yeah, that really is how it feels.
All right. So, Kelsey, we're going to start with the beer from Exhibit A that you brought. And Dan, this is part of the reason that we wanted you. So while Kelsey's going to make some noise here while he puts some glasses out, opens the beer. The beer, Dan, is called, wait for it, Sunday Paper. So what do you remember about your Sunday paper, Dan?
Well, you know, one of the problems in the newspaper business is that they lost all their classifieds. But you may recall that it wasn't that many years ago that it practically took two people to bring the Boston Globe in from the front porch because of all those section after section of classified ads. So that's pretty much gone away.
But I love that metaphor because this is a heavy beer, Kelsey, right?
It
this
is.
This is like the classified ads version of a...
Is there a print version of the Sunday paper?
Yeah, this is the this is like the online version, I think. But okay. Yeah, it's 9.9%.
So that's alcohol. For people who don't know in beer. Oh my god, that's a lot of alcohol. So Sarah and Dan and I are going to taste a little, and you're going to tell Kelsey, and then while we comment, you can taste. So you tell
Absolutely.
While we taste.
Yeah. So this beer is like I said, it's 9.9% alcohol. It's made with locally roasted and grown malts. So it's got a lot of local grain in it, and we partner with Barrington Coffee Roasters to add some coffee flavor to
that's
it.
That's what it is.
So, yeah.
Did you notice the coffee?
Yes, especially on the aftertaste.
Yeah.
I tend to like a heavier beer anyway, so I'm glad we started with the stout. This is terrific.
And I get the Sunday paper reference now, the little bit of coffee, the sort of comfort food dimension of it. Your reaction, Sarah, this is Kelsey's beer, your reaction to it.
I think it's beautifully balanced. You get the really nice roasty, malty notes from the coffee, and I'm assuming some of the rich malts that you're using for this beer. You definitely get a little bit of that alcohol burn, which is always really nice, I think, in the wintertime when you're trying to get cozy, and this is a great cozy beer.
Yeah, it warms you up a little bit inside.
Yeah.
All right. So in a minute, we're going to turn, Sarah, to you and Medusa and your first beer. But I want to talk for a second. One of the things that was striking to me, both in the first Brewed in Mass that we did, but also in studying your breweries for today, is the real effort that the companies seem to be making to play an important role in the local community. So here's a little more from Katie Stinchin of Mass Brewers Guild.
I certainly get calls from every downtown across Massachusetts saying, we want a brewery here. So there's also a lot of, no one's sad when a brewery moves into their town or their city. So I think that there is some demand for that as well.
So two things. One, first, I'm going to zero in on the no one is sad. We do still have dry towns. Sarah, we have eight of them, including places like Dunstable, for example. But it sounds like that is changing and that there's something about sort of anchor tenant, which I know has been your case in Hudson.
Sure.
That is changing that relationship.
Sure. So Medusa's been in Hudson for 7 years. When we first entered Hudson, it was a very quiet town. There wasn't a lot going on. Main Street was, you know, just smaller businesses that were kind of getting a little older. And so when we kind of entered the town, there was a huge kind of attempt to revitalize the community there. And I think what we're seeing with craft brewery and, you know, in Hudson, through our experience specifically, we realized that craft beer became a hub. It's a communion center point. It's not about necessarily always about the beer. It's not about, you know, just going to a bar. It's actually about bringing people together, bringing people of all different, you know, types of life, walks of life to this one focal point to just talk about whatever they wanted to talk about. It's a point of, I think, communion is a super important word. Kelsey and I talked about before, too. You know, sometimes we say we're not in the business of selling beer. We're actually in the experience of making sure you have a good experience, because beer just is a catalyst for that. It's just a small piece of that.
And you, Medusa Brewing, just opened Wild Hair, which is actually, I don't want to say more than just a brewery.
Sure.
Kind of trying to reflect that, right?
Yeah. So, you know, Hudson actually just plugged to Hudson. We won the greatest Main Street in America just with some of our local business partners out there. And Wild Hair, just we wanted to add to that sense of community. So Wild Hair is actually our barrel aging program. It's our oat conditioning program. And so we just do some more complex styles there. And one of my beers will feature that today.
So let's do that. That's the Hither and Yon.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about the Hither and Yon.
Sure.
And so we are, this is Sarah Lee, you're hearing from Medusa Brewing Company. We also have Kelsey Roth, who's at Exhibit A. Dan Kennedy from Northeastern is here as our taster. And this is us exploring the brewing industry in Massachusetts. So tell us about Hither and Yon.
Yeah, Sarah. Sure. So Hither and Yon is a really interesting beer. Wild Hair was named because, you know, it's an experience. When you do barrel aging, it's always a little bit of an experimental program. You don't really quite know how it's going to turn out. Also, there's the connection to the Medusa's wild hair, if you will.
Which is snakes.
Yes,
not
exactly.
Just hair.
And not just hair.
Let's
it's
be
snakes.
Clear. Yeah. It's snakes.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So this is one of, I think, just a really true reflection of that. So this has been, this is a beer that has been aged for 14 months in Cabernet barrels.
We're tasting while you're talking.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And so this one is a Flanders brown ale. So Flanders browns are known for being a little bit more slightly fruity with like plum, stone fruit.
Yeah,
it doesn't taste like beer.
I've never had anything like that before.
It's a very unique flavor. And because it's been aged in the 14 months in a Cabernet barrel, you're adding complexity. You're adding profile. So you get a little bit of that oak from that barrel. You get the fruitiness from the wine. You get a little bit of that tannic structure towards the finish. But in the beginning, you get malts, you get plum, you get dates, stone fruit. And this is actually a really great beer for, we've talked about before, people have a narrow-minded view of what beer's supposed to taste like, and this kind of shakes that mindset.
Yeah,
for you.
I would say if I were telling somebody, I would say it's not beer, it's Hither and Yon.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. So Dan, tell me about what your reaction is to tasting this.
You know, it was very surprising, that's for sure, and I picked up the Cabernet immediately.
Yeah.
That seemed to be, it almost tastes like a combination of if you poured beer and Cabernet into a glass.
In a way that tasted good.
Tasted good. Yeah, I know. It doesn't sound good, does it? This is terrific.
Thank you.
Kelsey, your reaction to Medusa's beer?
I think this is a fantastic example of the style. It has those like nice little cherry notes to it, you know, and you get the oak character as well. This is actually a style of beer that turned my brother into enjoying beer. He was just a wine person. I'm like, try this.
Okay, so let's then, because we're talking about holiday shopping, Sarah, you said this was a something, something, something type of beer, and I totally missed it. What is it?
So this is a Flanders brown ale. Okay. So this is a type of craft beer that a lot of people don't know about. It originated in Belgium. It has a slightly tart character. It's not like vinegary, but it has a slight tartness to it. But it has that stone fruit, that caramely taste almost, coffee notes I get as well.
And so, Kelsey, you're saying that if you know somebody who's interested in beer but likes wine, a Flanders brown ale might be a way to go.
Yeah, any of these like wine barrel aged sour beers are a great stepping point because you're already tapping into those flavor profiles that they understand and that they like.
And for the Sunday paper, A, at nearly 10% alcohol, to be probably drunk at home if you're going to give it to someone. And that's a local buy, right? Because you're working with Barrington Brewing coffees, mm-hmm. coffee roasters on
Absolutely.
That. Okay, so now the two of you have also brought in, and this is interesting, again, underscoring this ecosystem or ecosystem. You've brought in beers that you love that you didn't make, that other people made. And this is part of that, who do you shop for and how and what do you recommend? So, Kelsey, you brought something from Lost Shoe Brewing and Roasting in Marlboro. Is
yes.
that right? Mm-hmm. So tell us about it. And you can sort of, do we need to give you these back to pour out our glasses
sure.
so you can put more
yeah.
in? Okay. And so, I do want to point out, we are sipping responsibly here in Studio 2. We really are. We're doing it like a wine tasting. Everything gets poured back, and then we try again. So tell us about this one.
Yeah, so this beer is called Miracle on 19 Weed Street, and this is their Holiday IPA.
Okay.
So it's made with Cascade, Simcoe, and Chinook hops.
And so those are three kinds of hops.
Three kinds of hops.
Are any of those grown around here?
No, this isn't really a very good hop growing region.
Okay.
And they're not historically. We do have some hop farms now. We have Four Star Farms in Western Mass, and we have some hop farms in Maine. Sorry. I'm going to reach across the table.
That's Kelsey and me reaching across the table so I can get the glass.
And to add a little holiday flair to this, they brew it with spruce tips, too. So it adds like a little
spruce
bit
spruce like the tree.
Yeah.
Okay, right, Dan. That was my reaction, too. Okay, so listen. Sarah, have you tasted yet?
It's delightful.
All right, so you talk while I taste.
Yeah, I think this is really unique. It's very bright. You get the spruce right off the bat on the nose. It's really definitely there. You get like
you
a kind
do.
Of a botanical mm-hmm. vibe from this, almost like a gin. Because of that spruce, and then that hop finish is really mellow and a little citrusy, which is really nice.
Yeah, it's a hazy IPA,
mm-hmm,
correct?
Yep, definitely.
I'm a huge IPA fan, and I do enjoy the hazies. Dan, what do you taste here? Oh, Dan was still tasting.
I took a second small taste just because I'm trying to form my thoughts. You know, the spruce hints are really interesting. I kind of feel like beer makers have done hops to death, and I'm a little bit down on IPAs these days, but this is excellent. I like the spruce. It's just got a unique quality to it, and it's very drinkable.
Yeah.
Although I'm going to stop.
And, it almost feels to me like, it tastes to me like, you know when you go through a pine trees and they poke you a little bit? It's like the spruce is just poking you.
It has a little sharpness to it.
Right? Yeah, exactly. All right. So, Sarah, you brought in something from Redemption Rock Brewing Company in Worcester.
I did.
Okay.
So these are friends of mine in Worcester, run by a fantastic woman leader named Dani Babineau, CEO and founder. Redemption Rock, what's really unique and fun about them, they're actually a certified B Corp, which is really wonderful. They
run a new business model.
Yes, it is. It's basically a certification, basically kind of saying that the company is committing to just not only in the business market, but in the social economy market as well, being concerned about things like the environment, social welfare, and community, and that's built into their operations and business model, which is a very fun thing. And what I really love about them is that they also don't accept tips. They pay all of their workers a wage, and their tips get donated every single month to a different charity or a different organization in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Okay, so just before we taste, just tell us the name of this beer.
Yeah, so this beer is called Bière de Fête, which is French. It pretty much translates to like festive beer. This is a holiday beer.
It tastes like it.
Yeah, you get clove, you get ginger, some fun spices in there. It's got a dry finish with that little bit of that toffee notes that you may have tasted in the hither and yon as well. And it's just a really beautiful holiday beer. I think it would go really well with like a gingerbread cookie or...
it kind of tastes like a gingerbread
cookie. Yeah, exactly.
All right, so listen, while everybody tastes, I'm going to play a little sound from our last Brewed in Mass conversation. Our guest taster was Beth Chandler, who's the president of YW Boston. They've worked with Castle Island Brewing Company, who was our guest. Here's a little about why that partnership was important to her.
It's a predominantly male dominated field. And mm-hmm. so thinking about what can they do for folks who identify as women or those that are non-binary, how to ensure that they feel included both as employees and as folks who drink beer. Beer is often associated with white folks, not black folks, right? And so how do you make sure that that customers who are people of color feel welcome in breweries? So there's lots to talk about. There's lots that we can give to Castle Island and other brewers about thinking about why does diversity matter? Because it does.
So Kelsey, Sarah emphasized the diversity and the focus on justice of Redemption Rock Brewing. Tell us a little about what you taste in this beer and what you think of Beth's point as this industry, I mean, any ecosystem keeps somebody out.
Yeah. It's, first about the beer, this is like Christmas in a glass.
Yeah. Right?
I can feel the snow falling outside.
Yeah.
It's a big issue. It has been a big issue for a long time for the brewing industry. It's been very white and male for a long time. And, if we keep catering to that market, and just from a business standpoint, we're missing out on, a huge section of the population. And we're not that, it's like if you want to reflect the community and the neighborhoods you're in, you really need to include everybody. And create a welcoming space and a welcoming tap room that makes people want to come, and experience the beer that you have.
All right. And Dan Kennedy, four thumbs up on the four beers?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say Christmas in a glass is exactly the way I would describe it as well. I could easily picture drinking this with family and friends on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. I mean, it just seems like it's made for that.
All right, so Dan Kennedy, our guest taster, Northeastern University professor, Sarah Lee, director of business operations at Medusa Brewing Company and its sister restaurant, The Wild Hare, which are in Hudson, and Kelsey Roth, Cicerone, board member of the Mass Brewers Guild and general manager of Exhibit A Brewing Company in Framingham. Four great beers, three great guests. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston. Where do you go when you have, let's say, an ear infection or a fever? Maybe you sprain an ankle or a wrist. Ideally, that kind of thing, doctor's office. But some people have to go to the emergency room. That can cost more, it can take longer, and it can clog already strapped emergency departments. According to new data from the Center for Health Information and Analysis, Black and Hispanic residents were 60% and 110% more likely to visit the ER for non-emergency conditions, respectively. In this week's Business of Boston, we are looking what that does to our economy and to local business as well as people's health. So with us now, we're going to begin on the health side, Dr. Claire Cecile Pierre, Associate Chief Medical Officer and VP of Community Health Equity at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Claire Cecile, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to start on this health side. We've, since the beginning of the pandemic, we have had not even enough, but many conversations on Radio Boston about health equity. I'm assuming these numbers are not surprising to you, but is the magnitude surprising? 60% more likely if you're Black, 110% more likely if you're Hispanic or Latino.
My work focuses on community health and health equity, so the numbers are not surprising. They are painful to hear. They are exactly what we experience. And as a leader with lived experience of this, I'm an immigrant from Haiti, I see this in my family and I see it in our patients and in the communities we serve. Years, centuries of structural racism that have excluded people have forced us to make very difficult decisions about where to access care. The human suffering associated with this decision is not lost upon us. And so the numbers are sobering, but not surprising.
And I want to zero in on your phrase of human suffering, and you were speaking over that arc of time. But we inherently understand that there is something bad about not having good options other than going to the emergency room for a fever. So tell us a little bit about why it's problematic for the person who's sick to have to rely on an emergency department for non-emergent healthcare needs.
You know, when these decisions are made, people are doing an analysis. They are looking at their lives and they're looking at, and many of those people we think about as people who are different from us, but they are us. They are the person who works at the cafeteria and takes care of our children. They are the persons who take care of our elder family members on the night shift. So they need to have clinics that are open during the hours when they are available. And so for them, it's a difficult decision too. And so for the health system, it comes at a cost. And for them, it comes at the human cost of deciding, do I lose a shift where I won't get paid to actually get this kid taken care of? Or do I go after work in the emergency room? It ends up being the place that's open.
So we're talking in this Business of Boston segment with Dr. Claire Cecile Pierre of Brigham and Women's Hospital. And I'm going to add a second voice here. We've been talking about the health side. Let's bring in the business side. So also with us, Vasundhara Sangar, Vice President of Government Affairs at Associated Industries of Massachusetts, AIM is what it's often called. Vasundhara, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you're sitting here in Studio 2 as well, and the first thing that I'll note is that you were just nodding all the way along the way, especially in the conversation just now about I might have to miss a shift, or there's not a clinic that's available when I can go, or because I have to go and wait for a long time in an emergency room, the elder care that I'm doing so the next person can work their shift doesn't happen. This is an issue for our economy as well. Talk about that.
100%. We've seen a lot of folks and across industries in Massachusetts right now who are experiencing workforce shortages, difficulties attracting and retaining talent. And on top of that, if folks are, it's less likely for them to be in their workplace when they can be there if they're sidetracked by sickness or not receiving the care they need at the time that they need it or the place that they need it. That's going to affect overall business operations and for manufacturers, for healthcare workers themselves. It's really, again, like I said, it's stuff that we're hearing at AIM from our members across industries.
So that's an interesting thing I want to pick up on. Vasundhara, this is a report that's just come out for the Center for Health Information and Analysis. But it sounds like you're saying for members of Associated Industries, this has been on the radar for a while.
Definitely that. And I would also want to highlight decreasing emergency department usage is definitely something that employers have had their finger on that pulse for a minute. We've, before the pandemic even started, tried to coalesce a group of employer members to really talk about the issue of why emergency departments are used at such high rates, and what we can do in terms of educating our employees and educating our own networks about what other types of care are available to them, because that is, at the end of the day, going to drive down costs on all of us and allow for a more accessible pool of work.
So the headline here that we're talking about is the disproportionate need to use emergency rooms for non-emergency care among Black and Hispanic residents in Massachusetts. 60% more likely if you're Black, 110% more likely if you're Hispanic, but also the research, Dr. Claire Cecile, demonstrates that if you have lower what's called socioeconomic status, if you're lower income, that can be true for you as well. And of course, what we're talking about is already being vulnerable and then not having the resources and access to solve a problem that amplifies your vulnerability because it's your health. Is that fair?
That is fair. And, you know, the study actually also includes gender. So women were more likely, and different abilities, those who reported having physical, mental, or other difficulties that decreased their access, and therefore they used the emergency room more. We at Mass General Brigham understand this, and about 2 years ago committed to a United Against Racism strategy. And we realized that these took centuries, as we've said, to get to where we are, and it had to be system-wide across our academic medical centers, our community hospitals, our specialty hospitals, our community health centers. We all had to say that we're going to look at three major areas: who we are, diversity, equity, access, and belonging. Do we understand and do we have people across the system that are committed to making sure that every patient gets the same experience and the best outcome? And then we had to look at the patients we serve and what their experience actually is. And these are difficult and sensitive conversations. Going to our specialists and going to our, of course, our ER and other hospital parts of the hospitals, and making sure that our community centers have the right language access for the patients, the right hours for the patients, and extending and adjusting as needed. And then lastly, outside of our walls, to the communities that are near us and that we serve, and really understanding the upstream community health impact that we can do. And so we have committed in all three areas, from mobile services to digital access to care. Many people now get their care through a phone call, through a video call. And that is actually an equity issue, because if I'm going to lose pay, losing half a day to get access to care is a big deal for me. So having a 20-minute where I can step away from work and actually talk to my provider.
Literally on a break at work, for example.
Exactly. And so we're investing in efforts that will address all three of these areas.
So Vasundhara Sangar, one of the things that strikes me as I'm hearing Dr. Claire Cecile talk about this is traditionally somebody might say, well, wait, that means there's an unmet market opportunity here. Culturally appropriate, easily available where the demand is at hours that people can access it. We have solved such business problems, at least to some extent, other places. Now, I understand Dr. Claire Cecile's point about hundreds of years of distrust and marginalization, and that is a big nut to crack. Mm-hmm. But do we have a failure in the market to meet a legit paying demand as well?
I think that that's definitely an interesting insight, but I do think that a lot of various sectors of the healthcare economy are becoming more and more aware of these. Really, it's not that we haven't been looking at the gaps that exist in the care that's delivered, but that it's COVID-19, as it has with a lot of other issues, really exacerbated the problem here. And it really brought it to the forefront and made sure that folks were paying attention. And I'm proud to say that AIM was one of the companies that really stood up and wanted to say, how can we start collaborating and having these communications across the healthcare industry sectors? We have providers, we have carriers, we have big pharma, we have folks that we'd like to have at the table to have these conversations. And we have seen a lot of movement happening both between providers and carriers who are working together to see if they can create incentive-based models for payment in terms of incentivize reducing that inequity that we see in how care is delivered. And it's a lot of data collection, it's a lot of reporting, and it's a lot of collaboration and coming together to say that we have such different pieces of the pie. And like you said, this is such an open opportunity. And we know that it's better for all of us if we're collectively focusing on these goals. So what is it that we can do, and how can we work with policymakers to make that happen?
Do you have a number on this of any kind?
I don't.
Would it be hard to figure that out?
I mean, that is definitely a goal of ours. And again, that open communication and collaboration and making sure that we have all the sectors that are represented within AIMS membership and folks that are making these decisions for us in the State House and in Washington are educated on this.
And Dr. Cecile Pierre, Claire Cecile Pierre, do you have a number on this?
You know, it's great you raise this because you may be aware of the Health Equity Compact, where yes, over 55 leaders, black and brown leaders across the state have come together, healthcare leaders, have come together to advocate for policies that will be transformational but respond to our urgent needs, as well as make sure that within our institutions, like you were saying, that we're collaborating and increasing health equity. One of the main things that they start with is data and measurement. Michael Curry, who I'm sure you know well,
he announced the compact here on Radio Boston.
Yes. And so you know that he talks about this, and he looked at this study and said, well, this study is pointing to exactly why we at the compact continue and have to do our work, which is that when it comes to equity, you either pay now or you're going to pay greater later. And so the thought is that one of the mandates, one of the areas that we really want to focus on is to make sure that we understand and study the costs of inequities, both in terms of lives lost, but also economic opportunities, as you were mentioning, in addition to interventions that start providing care at the communities locally in culturally appropriate ways.
And Vasandra Sangar of Associated Industries, when we get better at this, when we have better access, when we have more equitable care, when people can more easily in the realities of their workday receive non-emergent care places other than emergency departments in an affordable ways. What becomes possible in the Massachusetts economy that's not possible today or less possible today?
I think the economic mobility that we really want to generate and create for, like we said, underserved residents, underrepresented residents in the state is one of the biggest things that we can look forward to when someone is able to say, hey, I have a tickle in my throat and I know where to go versus waiting until it's so much worse. That's going to help them retain their health. That's going to help them retain just peace of mind, quality of life. And investing in the health of our communities is going to help folks feel more capable and able to expand outside of those communities. And I've seen a lot of AIM members trying to diversify their workforces for the same reasons. We want to get more faces in here. We want to get more experiences in here so we can talk about how do we collectively come to these solutions. So I definitely see a real opportunity for economic mobility and prosperity once we have a better idea of how to get this care to the people when they need it and where they need it, and so they can move out of their communities and their communities can be better resourced.
I have no idea if either of you can answer this question, but do either of you know, Doctor, the people that are at the tables you're talking about, and Vasandra, the people that are at the tables you're talking about, do we know if any of those people are together at any tables?
I mean, MGB is an AIM member, so we've definitely been speaking to
Mass
General Brigham, yes. And so we've been talking, we've definitely been collaborating on their initiatives, and we have a number of members who are also on the Health Equity Compact, including the League of Community Health Centers and Dr. Michael Curry and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts. So we definitely have overlap within the healthcare sector and the industries that are talking about this and keeping a pulse on specifically the racial issues.
Completely agree, and this is why we think this moment is incredible. We now have leaders who are skilled and experienced, of course, but also have lived experience, which adds new perspective, and who are coming together towards one set of health advocacy and policies. And we have health systems like Mass General Brigham investing and partnering with community leaders in a different way, in a bigger way. And so this is a hopeful time, but these numbers really need to change, and we're all committed to doing that.
All right. That is Dr. Claire Cecile Pierre, the Associate Chief Medical Officer and VP of Community Health Equity at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and Vasandra Sangar, Vice President of Government Affairs at Associated Industries of Massachusetts. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director with help today from the whole team. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.